but even as he spoke them, the words were bitter in his mouth. Lanray, his face in shadow, darker than a starless night, was blown away like smoke upon the wind. Then Selytos bowed his head and wept hot tears of blood upon the earth.
It wasn't until Scarpi stopped speaking that I noticed how lost in the story I had become. He tilted his head back and drained the last of the wine from his wide clay cup. He turned it upside down and set it on the bar with a dull thump of finality. There was a small clamor of questions, comments, pleas, and thanks from children who had remained still as stones throughout the story. Scarpi made a small gesture to the barkeep, who set out a mug of beer as the children began to trickle out onto the street. I waited until the last of them had left before I approached him. He turned those diamond blue eyes on me and I stammered.
Thank you. I wanted to thank you. My father would have loved that story. It's the...
I broke off.
I wanted to give you this.
I brought out an iron halfpenny.
I didn't know what was going on, so I didn't pay.
My voice seemed rusty. This was probably more than I had spoken in a month. He looked closely at me.
Here are the rules, he said, ticking them off on his gnarled fingers. 1. Don't talk while I'm talking. 2. Give a small coin if you have it to spare.
He looked at the halfpenny on the bar. Not wanting to admit how much I needed it, I sought for something else to say.
Do you know many stories?
He smiled, and the network of lines that crossed his face turned to make themselves part of that smile.
I only know one story, but oftentimes small pieces seem to be stories themselves.
He took a drink.
It's growing all around us, in the manor houses of the Kaeldim and in the workshops of the Kaeldar, over the Stormwell and the Great Sand Sea. In the low stone houses of the Ardim, full of silent conversation. And sometimes,
he smiled,
sometimes the story is growing in squalid backstreet bars, dockside, in Tarbin.
His bright eyes looked deep into me as if I were a book that he could read.
There's no good story that doesn't touch the truth,
I said, repeating something my father used to say, mostly to fill the silence. It felt strange talking to someone again, strange but good.
There's as much truth here as anywhere, I suppose. It's too bad. The world could do with a little less truth and a little more...
I trailed off, not knowing what I wanted more of. I looked down at my hands and found myself wishing they were cleaner. He slid the halfpenny towards me. I picked it up and he smiled. His rough hand lit lightly as a bird on my shoulder.
Every day, except morning. 6 bell, more or less.
I started to leave, then stopped.
Is it true?
The story? I made an inarticulate gesture.
The part you told today?
All stories are true, Scarpi said. But this one really happened, if that's what you mean.
He took another slow drink, then smiled again, his bright eyes dancing.
More or less. You have to be a bit of a liar to tell a story the right way. Too much truth confuses the facts. Too much honesty makes you sound insincere.
My father used to say the same thing.
As soon as I mentioned him, a confusing welter of emotions rose up in me. Only when I saw Scarpi's eyes following me did I realize I was backing nervously toward the exit. I stopped and forced myself to turn and walk out the door.
I'll be here, if I can.
I heard the smile in his voice behind me.
I know.
Chapter 27. His eyes unveiled. I left the bar, smiling, unmindful of the fact that I was still dockside and in danger.
I felt buoyant knowing I would have the chance to hear another story soon. It had been a long time since I had looked forward to anything. I went back to my street corner and proceeded to waste 3 hours begging, not gaining so much as a thin shim for my efforts. Even this failed to dampen my spirits. Tomorrow was morning, but the day after there would be stories. But as I sat there, I felt a vague unease creep over me. A feeling that I was forgetting something impinged on my too rare happiness. I tried to ignore it, but it stayed with me all day and into the next, like a mosquito I couldn't see, let alone swat. By the end of the day, I was certain I had forgotten something. Something about the story Scarpy had told. It is easy for you to see, no doubt, hearing the story like this, conveniently arranged and narrated. Keep in mind that I had been living like an animal in Tarbin for nearly 3 years. Pieces of my mind were still asleep, and my painful memories had been gathering dust behind the door of forgetfulness. I'd grown used to avoiding them, the same way a cripple keeps weight off an injured leg. Luck smiled on me the next day, and I managed to steal a bundle of rags off the back of a wagon and sell them to a ragman for 4 iron pennies. Too hungry to worry about tomorrow, I bought a thick slice of cheese and a warm sausage, then a whole loaf of fresh bread and a warm apple tart. Finally, on a whim, I went to the back door of the nearby inn and spent my final penny on a mug of strong beer. I sat on the steps of a bakery across the street from the inn and watched people coming and going as I enjoyed my best meal in months. Soon twilight faded into darkness, and my head began to spin pleasantly from the beer. But as the food settled in my belly, the nagging sensation returned, stronger than before. I frowned, irritated that something would spoil an otherwise perfect day. Night deepened until the inn across the street stood in a pool of light. A few women hovered near the doorway to the inn. They murmured in low voices and gave knowing looks to the men who walked past. I drank off the last of the beer, and was about to cross the street and return the mug when I saw a flicker of torchlight approaching. Looking down the street, I saw the distinctive grey of a Telin priest and decided to wait until he had passed. Drunk on morning, and just recently a thief, I guessed the less contact I had with the clergy, the better off I'd be. He was hooded, and the torch he carried was between us, so I couldn't see his face. He approached the group of nearby women, and there was a low murmur of discussion. I heard the distinctive chink of coins and sunk further into the shadow of the doorway. The Telin turned and headed back the way he had come. I remained still, not wanting to draw his attention, not wanting to have to run for safety while my head was spinning. This time, however, the torch was not between us. When he turned to look in my direction, I could see nothing of his face, only darkness under the cowl of his hood. Only shadow. He continued on his way, unaware of my presence or uncaring, but I stayed where I was, unable to move. The image of the hooded man, his face hidden in shadow, had thrown open a door in my mind, and memories were spilling out. I was remembering a man with empty eyes and a smile from a nightmare, remembering the blood on his sword. Cinder, his voice like a chill wind.
Is this your parents' fire?
Not him. The man behind him. The quiet one who had sat beside the fire. The man whose face was hidden in shadow. Haliax. This had been the half-remembered thing hovering on the edge of my awareness since I had heard Scarpy's story. I ran to the rooftops and wrapped myself in my rag blanket. Pieces of story and memory slowly fit together. I began to admit impossible truths to myself. The Chandrian were real. Haliax was real. If the story Scarpy had told was true, then Lanray and Haliax were the same person. The Chandrian had killed my parents, my whole troop. Why? Other memories bubbled to the surface of my mind. I saw the man with black eyes, Cinder, kneeling in front of me. His face expressionless, his voice sharp and cold.
Someone's parents, he had said, have been singing entirely the wrong sort of songs.
They had killed my parents for gathering stories about them. They had killed my whole troop over a song. I sat awake all night with little more than these thoughts running through my head. Slowly I came to realize them as the truth. What did I do then? Did I swear I would find them, kill them all for what they had done? Perhaps. But even if I did, I knew in my heart it was impossible. Tarbin had taught me hard practicality. Kill the Chandrin? Kill Lanre? How could I even begin? I would have more luck trying to steal the moon. At least I knew where to look for the moon at night. But there was one thing I could do. Tomorrow, I would ask Scarpi for the real truth behind his stories. It wasn't much, but it was all I had. Revenge might be beyond me, at least for now, but I still had a hope of knowing the truth. I held tight to that hope through the dark hours of night, until the sun rose, and I fell asleep.
Chapter 28 Telu's Watchful Eye. The next day, I came blearily awake to the sound of the hour being struck. I counted 4 bells, but I didn't know how many I might have slept through. I blinked the sleep from my eyes and tried to gauge the time from the position of the sun. About 6th bell. Scarpi would be starting his story now. I ran through the streets, my bare feet slapped on rough cobbles, splashing through puddles and taking shortcuts through alleyways. Everything became a blur around me as I pulled in great lungfuls of the damp, stagnant city air. I almost burst into the half-mast at a dead run and settled in against the back wall by the door. I dimly realized there were more people in the inn than usual this early in the evening. Then Scarpi's story pulled me in, and I could do nothing but listen to his deep, rolling voice and watch his sparkling eyes.
Selissos, one eye, stood forward and said, Lord, if I do this thing, will I be given the power to avenge the loss of the Shining City? Can I confound the plots of Lanre and his Chandrian, who killed the innocent and burned my beloved Mir Tirinil? Aleph said, No, all personal things must be set aside, and you must punish or reward only what you yourself witness from this day forth. Selitzos bowed his head. I am sorry, but my heart says to me I must try to stop these things before they are done, not wait and punish later. Some of the Ruach murmured agreement with Selitzos and went to stand with him, for they remembered Mir Tirinil and were filled with rage and hurt at Lanre's betrayal. Selitzos went to Aleph and knelt before him. I must refuse, for I cannot forget, but I will oppose him with these faithful Ruach beside me. I see their hearts are pure. We will be called the Amir, in memory of the ruined city. We will confound Lanre and any who follow him. Nothing will prevent us from attaining the greater good. Most of the Ruach hung back from Selitzos too. They were afraid, and they did not wish to become involved in great matters. But Telu stood forward, saying, I hold justice foremost in my heart. I will leave this world behind that I might better serve it, serving you. He knelt before Aleph, his head bowed, his hands open at his sides. Others came forward. Tal-Kirel, who had been burned but left living in the ash of Mir Tirinil. Dea, who had lost 2 husbands to the fighting and whose face and mouth and heart were hard and cold as stone. Enlas, who would not carry a sword or eat the flesh of animals and who no man had ever known to speak hard words. Fair Gaeser, who had 100 suitors in Balin before the walls fell. The first woman to know the unasked-for touch of man. Lekelt, who laughed easily and often, even when there was woe thick about him. Imet, hardly more than a boy, who never sang and killed swiftly without tears.
Ordor, the youngest of them all, who had never seen a thing die, stood bravely before Aleph, her golden hair bright with ribbon. And beside her came Andan, whose face was a mask with burning eyes, whose name meant anger. They came to Aleph, and he touched them. He touched their hands and eyes and hearts. The last time he touched them there was pain, and wings tore from their backs that they might go where they wished. Wings of fire and shadow, wings of iron and glass, wings of stone and blood. Then Aleph spoke their long names, and they were wreathed in a white fire. The fire danced along their wings, and they became swift. The fire flickered in their eyes, and they saw into the deepest hearts of men. The fire filled their mouths, and they sang songs of power. Then the fire settled on their foreheads like silver stars, and they became at once righteous and wise and terrible to behold. Then the fire consumed them, and they were gone forever from mortal sight. None but the most powerful can see them, and only then with great difficulty and at great peril. They mete out justice to the world. And Telu is the greatest of them all.
I have heard enough.
The speaker wasn't loud, but he may as well have shouted. When Scarpy told a story, any interruption was like chewing a grain of sand in a mouthful of bread. From the back of the room, two men in dark cloaks came towards the bar, one tall and proud, one short and hooded. As they walked, I saw a flash of grey robe beneath their cloaks. Telin priests. Worse, I saw two other men with armor under their cloaks. I hadn't seen it while they were sitting, but now that they were moving, it was painfully obvious they were church strongmen. Their faces were grim, and the lines of their cloaks spoke of swords to me. I wasn't the only one who saw. The children were trickling out the door. The smarter ones tried to appear casual, but some broke into a run before they got outside. Against common sense, three children stayed. There was a Caeldish boy with lace on his shirt, a little girl with bare feet, and myself.
I believe we have all heard enough,
the taller of the two priests said with quiet severity. He was lean with sunken eyes that smoldered like half-hidden coals. A carefully trimmed beard the color of soot sharpened the edges of his knife-blade face. He handed his cloak to the shorter, hooded priest. Underneath he wore the pale grey robe of the Telin. Around his neck was a set of silver scales. My heart sunk deep into the pit of my stomach. Not just a priest, but a justice. I saw the other two children slip out the door. The justice spoke.
Under Telu's watchful eye, I charge you with heresy.
Witness,
said the second priest from within his hood. The justice motioned to the mercenaries.
Bind him.
This the mercenaries did with rough efficiency. Scarpy endured the whole thing placidly without saying a word. The justice watched his bodyguard begin to tie Scarpy's wrists, then turned his body slightly away as if dismissing the storyteller from his mind. He took a long look around the room, his inspection finally ending with the bald, aproned man behind the bar.
Taylor's blessing be upon you,
the owner of the half-mask stammered explosively.
It is,
the justice said simply. He took another long look around the room. Finally, he turned his head to the second priest who stood back from the bar.
Anthony, would a fine place such as this be harboring heretics? Anything is possible, justice.
Ah,
the justice said softly and looked slowly around the room, once again ending with an inspection of the man behind the bar.
Can I offer your honours a drink, if it please you?
The owner offered quickly. There was only silence.
I mean, a drink for you and your brothers, a fine barrel of fallow white, to show my thanks. I'll let him stay because his stories were interesting at first.
He swallowed hard and hurried on,
but then he started to say wicked things. I was afraid to throw him out because he's obviously mad, and everyone knows God's displeasure falls heavy on those who raise their hands to madmen.
His voice broke, leaving the room suddenly quiet. He swallowed, and I could hear the dry click his throat made from where I stood by the door.
A generous offer,
the justice said finally.
Very generous,
echoed the shorter priest.
However, strong drink sometimes tempts men to wicked actions. Wicked,
whispered the priest.
And some of our brothers have taken vows against the temptations of the flesh. I must refuse.
The justice's voice dripped pious regret.
I managed to catch Scarpy's eye. He gave me a little half-smile. My stomach churned. The old storyteller didn't seem to have any idea what sort of trouble he was in. But at the same time, deep inside me, something selfish was saying, if you'd come earlier and found out what you needed to know, it wouldn't be so bad now, would it? The barman broke the silence.
Could you take the price of the barrel then, sirs, if not the barrel itself?
The justice paused as if thinking.
For the sake of the children?
The bald man pleaded.
I know you will use the money for them.
The justice pursed his lips.
Very well,
he said after a moment.
For the sake of the children.
The shorter priest's voice had an unpleasant edge.
The children.
The owner managed a weak smile. Scarpy rolled his eyes at me and winked.
You would think,
Scarpy's voice rolled out like thick honey.
Fine churchmen such as yourselves could find better things to do than arresting storytellers and extorting money from honest men.
The clinking of the barman's coins trailed off, and the room seemed to hold its breath. With a studied casualness, the justice turned his back toward Scarpy and spoke over one shoulder toward the shorter priest.
Antony, we seem to have found a courteous heretic. How strange and wonderful. We should sell him to a Rue troop. In a way, he resembles a talking dog.
Scarpy spoke to the man's back.
It's not as if I expect you to bound off looking for Haliax and the Seven yourself. Small deeds for small men, I always say. I imagine the trouble is in finding the job small enough for men such as yourselves. But you are resourceful. You could pick trash or check brothel beds for lice when you're visiting.
Turning, the justice snatched the clay up off the bar and dashed it against Scarpy's head, shattering it.
Do not speak in my presence,
he crackled.
You know nothing.
Scarpy shook his head a little as if to clear it. A trickle of red lined its way down his driftwood face, down into one of his sea foam eyebrows.
I suppose that could be true. Telu always said.
Do not speak his name,
the justice screamed, his face a livid red.
Your mouth dirties it. It is a blasphemy upon your tongue.
Oh, come now, Erlus,
Scarpy chided, as though talking to a small child.
Selu hates you even more than the rest of the world does, which is quite a bit.
The room became unnaturally still. The justice's face grew pale.
God have mercy on you,
he said in a cold, trembling voice. Scarpy looked at the justice mutely for a moment. Then he started to laugh. Great, booming, helpless laughter from the bottom of his soul. The eyes of the justice flicked to one of the men who had tied the storyteller. With no preamble, the grim-faced man struck Scarpy with a tight fist, once in the kidney, once in the back of the neck. Scarpy crumpled to the ground. The room was silent. The sound of his body hitting the wood planking of the floor seemed to fade before the echoes of his laughter did. At a gesture from the justice, one of the guards picked the old man up by the scruff of his neck. He dangled like a rag doll, his feet trailing on the ground. But Scarpy was not unconscious, merely stunned. The storyteller's eyes rolled around to focus on the justice.
Mercy on my soul.
He gave a weak croak that might have been a chuckle on a better day.
You don't know how funny that sounds coming from you.
Scarpy seemed to address the air in front of him.
You should run, Quoth. There's nothing to be gained by meddling with these sort of men. Head to the rooftops. Stay where they won't see you for a while. I have friends in the church who can help me, but there's nothing you can do here. Go!
Since he wasn't looking at me when he spoke, there was a moment of confusion. The justice gestured again, and one of the guards struck Scarpy a blow to the back of the head. His eyes rolled back, and his head lolled forwards. I slipped out the door, onto the street. I took Scarpy's advice, and was on a rooftop running before they left the bar. Chapter 29. The Doors of My Mind. Up onto the rooftops and back to my secret place, I wrapped myself in my blanket and cried. I cried as if something inside me had broken and everything was rushing out. When I had worn myself out with sobbing, it was deep into the night. I lay there looking at the sky, weary but unable to sleep. I thought of my parents and of the troop and was surprised to find the memories less bitter than before. For the first time in years, I used one of the tricks Ben had taught me for calming and sharpening the mind. It was harder than I remembered, but I did it. If you have ever slept the whole night without moving, then awoke in the morning, your body stiff with inaction. If you can remember how that first terrific stretch feels, pleasant and painful, then you may understand how my mind felt after all these years, stretching awake on the rooftops of Tarbin. I spent the rest of that night opening the doors of my mind. Inside, I found things long forgotten. My mother fitting words together for a song, diction for the stage, 3 recipes for tea to calm nerves and promote sleep, 5 scales for the lute. My music. Had it really been years since I held a lute? I spent a long time thinking about the Chandrian, about what they had done to my troop, what they had taken from me. I remembered blood and the smell of burning hair and felt a deep, sullen anger burning in my chest. I will admit I thought dark, vengeful thoughts that night. But my years in Tarbin had instilled an iron-hard practicality. I knew revenge was nothing more than a childish fantasy. I was 15, what could I possibly do? I did know one thing. It had come to me as I lay remembering. It was something Haliax had said to Cinder.
Who keeps you safe from the Amir? The singers, the scythe, from all that would harm you in the world.
The Chandrian had enemies. If I could find them, they would help me. I had no idea who the singers or the scythe were, but everyone knew that the Amir were church knights, the strong right hand of the Aturan Empire. Unfortunately, everyone also knew that there had been no Amir in 300 years. They had been disbanded when the Aturan Empire collapsed. But Haliax had spoken of them as if they still existed, and Scarpy's story implied that the Amir had begun with Selitos, not with the Aturan Empire, as I had always been taught. There was obviously more to the story, more that I needed to know. The more I thought on it, the more questions arose. The Chandrian obviously didn't kill everyone who gathered stories or sang songs about them. Everyone knew a story or two about them, and every child at one point has sung the silly rhyme about their signs. What made my parents' song so different? I had questions. There was only one place for me to go, of course. I looked over my meager possessions. I had a rag blanket and a burlap sack with some straw that I used for a pillow. I had a pint bottle with a cork in it half full of clean water, a piece of canvas sailcloth that I weighted down with bricks and used as a windbreak on cold nights, a crude pair of salt dice, and a single tatty shoe that was too small for me, but that I hoped to trade for something else. And 27 iron pennies in common coin. My rainy day money. A few days ago it had seemed like a vast treasure trove, but now I knew it would never be enough. As the sun was rising, I removed rhetoric and logic from its hiding place underneath a rafter. I unwrapped the scrap of treated canvas I used to protect it, and was relieved to find it dry and well. I felt the smooth leather in my hands. I held it to my face and smelled the back of Ben's wagon, spice and yeast with the bitter tang of acids and chemical salts mingled in. It was the last tangible piece of my past. I opened it to the first page and read the inscription Ben had made more than 3 years ago. Quoth, "Defend yourself well at the university. Make me proud. Remember your father's song. Be wary of folly. Abenthi." I nodded to myself and turned the page. Chapter 30. The Broken Binding. The sign over the doorpost read, "The Broken Binding." I took it to be an auspicious sign and walked in. A man sat behind a desk. I assumed he was the owner. He was tall and reedy with thinning hair. He looked up from a ledger, his expression vaguely irritated. Deciding to keep niceties to a minimum, I walked to his desk and handed him the book. "How much would you give me for this?" He leafed through it professionally, feeling the paper between his fingers, checking the binding. He shrugged. "A couple of jots." "It's worth more than that," I said indignantly. "It's worth what you can get for it," he said matter-of-factly. "I'll give you 1.5. 2 talents, and I have the option to buy it back for a month." He gave a short, barking laugh. "Ha! This is not a pawn shop." He slid the book across the desk towards me with one hand as he picked up his pen with the other. 20 days? He hesitated, then gave the book another cursory once-over and brought out his purse. He pulled out 2 heavy silver talents. It was more money than I'd seen in one place for a long, long time. He slid them across the desk. I restrained the desire to snatch them up immediately and said, "I'll need a receipt." This time he gave me such a long, hard look that I began to get a little nervous. It was only then I realized how I must look, covered in a year's worth of alley dirt, trying to get a receipt for a book I'd obviously stolen. Eventually he gave another bland shrug and scratched out a note on a slip of paper. At the bottom of it he drew a line and made a motion with his pen. "Sign here." I looked at the paper. It read, "I, by signing below, hereby attest to the fact that I can neither read nor write." I looked up at the owner. He held a straight face. I dipped the pen and carefully wrote the letters DD as if they were initials. He fanned the ink dry and slid my receipt across the desk toward me.
"What does D stand for?"
he asked with the barest hint of a smile.
"Defeasance," I said. "It means to render something null and void, usually a contract. The second D is for decrepitate, which is the act of throwing someone into a fire."
He gave me a blank look.
"Decrepitation is the punishment for forgery in Junpui. I think false receipts fall in that category."
I made no move to touch the money or the receipt. There was a tense silence.
"This isn't Junpui,"
he said, his face carefully composed. "True enough," I admitted.
"You have a keen sense of defalcation. Perhaps I should add a third, D."
He gave another sharp, barking laugh and smiled.
"Ah, you've convinced me, young master."
He pulled out a fresh slip of paper and set it in front of me.
"You write me a receipt, and I will sign it."
I took up the pen and wrote, "I, the undersigned, do agree to return the copy of the book Rhetoric and Logic with the inscription to Quoth, to the bearer of this note in exchange for 2 silver pennies, provided he present this receipt before the date." I looked up.
"What day is it?"
Shuden, the 35th.
I'd fallen out of the habit of keeping track of the date. On the streets, one day is largely the same as the next, save that people are a little more drunk on Hepton, a little more generous on mourning. But if it was the 35th, then I only had 5 days to get to the university. I knew from Ben that admissions only lasted until Kendling. If I missed them, I would have to wait 2 months for the next term to start. I filled in the date on the receipt and drew a line for the bookseller to sign. He looked a little bemused as I slid the paper toward him. What's more, he didn't notice that the receipt read pennies instead of talents. Talents were worth significantly more. This meant he had just agreed to give me back the book for less money than he had bought it for. My satisfaction damped itself when it occurred to me how foolish all of this was. Pennies or talents, I wouldn't have enough money to buy the book back in 2 span. If everything went well, I wouldn't even be in Tarbin tomorrow. Despite its uselessness, the receipt helped ease the sting of parting with the last thing I owned from my childhood. I blew on the paper, folded it carefully into a pocket, and collected my 2 silver talents. I was surprised when the man held out his hand to me. He smiled in an apologetic way.
"Sorry about the note, but you didn't look like you'd be coming back."
He gave a little shrug.
"Here."
He pressed a copper jot into my hand. I decided that he was not an altogether bad fellow. I smiled back at him, and for a second I almost felt guilty about how I'd written the receipt. I also felt guilty about the 3 pens I'd stolen. But only for a second. And since there was no convenient way to give them back, I stole a bottle of ink before I left. Chapter 31. The Nature of Nobility. The 2 talents had a reassuring weight to them that had nothing to do with how heavy they were. Anyone who has been without money for a long time will know what I'm talking about. My first investment was a good leather purse. I wore it underneath my clothes, tight against my skin. Next was a real breakfast, a plateful of hot eggs and a slice of ham, bread that was fresh and soft, plenty of honey and butter on the side, and a glass of milk not 2 days from the cow. It cost me 5 iron pennies. It may be the best meal I ever ate. It felt strange sitting at a table, eating with a knife and fork. It felt strange being around people. It felt strange having a person bring me food. As I mopped up the remnants of my breakfast with an end of bread, I realized that I had a problem. Even in this slightly grubby inn waterside, I was attracting attention. My shirt was nothing more than an old burlap sack with holes for my arms and head. My trousers were made out of canvas and too big by several degrees. They reeked of smoke, grease, and stagnant alley water. I'd been holding them up with the length of rope I had dug out of some trash. I was filthy, barefoot, and I stank. Should I buy clothes or try to find a bath? If I bathed first, I would have to wear my old clothes afterward. However, if I tried to buy clothes looking the way I did now, I might not even be let into the store, and I doubted that anyone would want to measure me for a fit. The innkeep came to take my plate, and I decided on a bath first, mainly because I was sick to death of smelling like a weak, dead rat. I smiled up at him.
"Where can I find a bath near here?"
"Here, if you have a couple of pennies."
He looked me over.
"Or I'll work you an hour instead, a good hard hour. The half could use scrubbing."
"I'll need a lot of water and soap."
2 hours then. I've got dishes too. Half first, then bath, then dishes. Fair?"
An hour or so later, my shoulders ached and the hearth was clean. He showed me to a back room with a large wooden tub and a grate on the floor. There were pegs along the walls for clothes, and a sheet of tin nailed to the wall served as a crude mirror. He brought me a brush, a bucket of steaming water, and a cake of lye soap. I scrubbed until I was sore and pink. The innkeeper brought a second bucket of hot water, then a third.
I gave a silent prayer of thanks that I didn't seem to be lousy. I had probably been too filthy for any self-respecting louse to take up residence. As I rinsed myself for the last time, I looked at my discarded clothes. Cleaner than I'd been in years, I didn't want to touch them, let alone wear them. If I tried to wash them, they'd simply fall apart. I dried myself off and I used the rough brush to pull through the snarls in my hair. It was longer than it had seemed when it was dirty. I wiped the fog from the makeshift mirror and was surprised. I looked old. Older, at any rate. Not only that, I looked like some young noble's son. My face was lean and fair, my hair needed a bit of a trim but was shoulder-length and straight, as was the current fashion. The only thing missing was a noble's clothes. And that gave me an idea. Still naked, I wrapped myself in a towel and left by the back door. I took my purse but kept it out of sight. It was a little before noon and people were everywhere. Needless to say, quite a few eyes were turned in my direction. I ignored them and set a brisk pace, not trying to hide. I composed my features into an impassive, angry mask without a trace of embarrassment. I stopped by a father and son loading burlap sacks into a cart. The son was about 4 years older than me and head and shoulders taller. "Boy," I snapped, "where can I buy some clothes around here?" I looked pointedly at his shirt. "Decent clothes," I amended. He looked at me, his expression somewhere between confusion and anger. His father hurriedly took off his hat and stepped in front of his son.
"Your lordship might trouble Bentley's, it's plain stuff, but it's only a street or two away."
I darkened my expression.
"Is it the only place about?"
he gaped.
"Well, it could, there's one..."
I waved him impatiently into silence.
"Where is it? Simply point, since your wits have left you."
He pointed and I strode off. As I walked, I remembered one of the young page parts I used to play in the troop. The page's name was Dunsty, an insufferably petulant little boy with an important father. He was perfect. I gave my head an imperious tilt, set my shoulders a little differently, and made a couple of mental adjustments. I threw open the door and stormed in. There was a man in a leather apron who I can only assume was Bentley. He was 40-ish, thin and balding. He jumped at the sound of his door banging against the wall. He turned to look at me, his expression incredulous.
"Fetch me a robe, Lackwit. I'm sick of being gawked at by you and every other mueller that decided to go marketing today."
I slouched into a chair and sulked. When he didn't move, I glared at him.
"Did I stutter? Are my needs perhaps inobvious?"
I tugged at the edge of my towel to demonstrate. He stood there, gaping. I lowered my voice menacingly.
"If you don't bring me something to wear..." I stood up and shouted. "I'll tear this place apart! I'll ask my father for your stones as a midwinter gift! I'll have his dogs mount your dead corpse! Do you have any idea who I am?"
Bentley scurried away, and I threw myself back into the chair. A customer I hadn't noticed until now made a hurried exit, stopping briefly to curtsy to me before she left. I fought back the urge to laugh. After that, it was surprisingly easy. I kept him running about for half an hour, bringing me one piece of clothing or another. I mocked the material, the cut, the workmanship of everything he brought out. In short, I was the perfect little brat. In truth, I couldn't have been more pleased. The clothing was plain but well made. Indeed, compared to what I had been wearing an hour before, a clean burlap sack would have been a great step up. If you haven't spent much time in court or in large cities, you won't understand why this was so easy for me to accomplish. Let me explain. Nobles' sons are one of nature's great destructive forces, like floods or tornadoes. When you're struck with one of these catastrophes, the only thing an average man can do is grit his teeth and try to minimize the damage. Bentley knew this. He marked the shirt and trousers and helped me out of them. I got back into the robe he had given me, and he began sewing like the devil was breathing down his neck. I flounced back into the chair.
You may as well ask. I can tell you're dying of curiosity.
He looked up briefly from his stitching.
Sir?
The circumstances surrounding my current state of undress.
Ah, yes.
He tied off the thread and began on the trousers.
I will admit to a slight curiosity, no more than proper. I'm not one to pry into anyone's business.
Ah, I nodded, pretending disappointment.
A laudable attitude.
There followed a long moment. The only sound was that of the thread being drawn through cloth. I fidgeted. Finally, I continued, as if he had asked me.
A whore stole my clothes.
Really, sir?
Yes, she tried to get me to trade them for my purse, the bitch.
Bentley looked up briefly, genuine curiosity on his face.
Wasn't your purse with your clothes, sir?
I looked shocked.
Certainly not! A gentleman's hand is never far away from his purse, so my father says.
I waved my purse at him to make my point. I noticed him trying to suppress a laugh, and it made me feel a little better. I'd made the man miserable for almost an hour. The least I could give him was a story to tell his friends.
She told me if I wanted to keep my dignity, then I'd give her my purse and walk home wearing my clothes. I shook my head scornfully. Wanton, I said to her, a gentleman's dignity isn't in his clothes. If I handed over my purse simply to save myself an embarrassment, then I would be handing over my dignity.
I looked thoughtful for a second, then spoke softly as if thinking aloud.
It only follows that a gentleman's dignity is in his purse, then.
I looked at the purse in my hands and gave a long pause.
I think I heard my father say something of the sort the other day.
Bentley gave a laugh that he turned into a cough, then stood up and shook out the shirt and trousers.
There you go, sir. Fit you like a glove now.
A hint of a smile played around his lips as he handed them to me. I slid out of the robe and pulled on the trousers.
They'll get me home, I suppose. How much for your trouble, Bentley?
I asked. He thought for a second.
1 and 2.
I began to lace up my shirt and said nothing.
Sorry, sir,
he said quickly.
Forgot who I was dealing with.
He swallowed.
1 even would do nicely.
Taking out my purse, I put 1 silver talent into his hand and looked him in the eye.
I will be needing a sum change.
His mouth made a thin line, but he nodded and handed me back 2 jots. I tucked the coins away and tied my purse firmly underneath my shirt, then gave him a meaningful look and patted it. I saw the smile tug at his lips again.
Goodbye, sir.
I picked up my towel, left the store, and started my altogether less conspicuous walk back to the inn where I had found breakfast and a bath.
What can I get for you, young sir?
The innkeeper asked as I approached the bar. He smiled and wiped his hands on his apron.
A stack of dirty dishes and a rag.
He squinted at me, then smiled and laughed.
Oh, I thought you'd run off naked through the streets.
Not quite naked. I laid his towel on the bar.
There was more dirt than boy before, and I would have bet a solid mark your hair was black. You really don't look the same.
He marvelled mutely for a second.
Would you like your old clothes?
I shook my head.
Throw them away. Actually, burn them and make sure no one accidentally breathes the smoke.
He laughed again.
I did have some other items, though,
I reminded him. He nodded and tapped the side of his nose.
Right enough, just a second.
He turned and disappeared through a doorway behind the bar. I let my attention wander around the room. It seemed different now that I wasn't attracting hostile stares. The fieldstone fireplace with the black kettle simmering, the slightly sour smells of varnished wood and spilled beer, the low rumble of conversation. I've always had a fondness for taverns. It comes from growing up on the road, I think. A tavern is a safe place, a refuge of sorts. I felt very comfortable just then, and it occurred to me that it wouldn't be a bad life, owning a place like this.
Here you go, then,
The innkeeper laid down 3 pens, a jar of ink, and my receipt from the bookstore.
These gave me almost as much of a puzzle as why you would run off without your clothes.
I'm going to the university, I explained.
He raised an eyebrow.
A little young, aren't you?
I felt a nervous chill at his words, but shrugged it off.
They take all kinds.
He nodded politely as if that explained why I had shown up barefoot and reeking of back alleys. After waiting for a while to see if I'd elaborate, the barman poured himself a drink.
No offence, but you don't exactly look to be the sort who would want to be washing dishes any more.
I opened my mouth to protest. An iron penny for an hour's work was a bargain I was hesitant to pass up. 2 pennies was the same as a loaf of bread, and I couldn't count all the times that I'd been hungry in the last year. Then I saw my hands resting on the bar. They were pink and clean. I almost didn't recognize them for my own. I realized then I didn't want to do the dishes. I had more important things to do. I stood back from the bar and got a penny from my purse.
Where's the best place to find a caravan leaving for the north?
I asked.
Drover's Lot, up hillside, 1/4 mile past the mill on Green Street.
I felt a nervous chill when hillside was mentioned. I ignored it as best I could and nodded.
You have a lovely inn here. I'd count myself lucky to have one as nice when I've grown up.
I handed him the penny. He broke into a huge smile and handed back the penny.
With such nice compliments, you come back any time.
Chapter 32. Coppers, Cobblers, and Crowds. It was about an hour before noon when I stepped out onto the street. The sun was out and the cobblestones were warm beneath my feet. As the noise of the market rose to an irregular hum around me, I tried to enjoy the pleasant sensation of having a full belly and a clean body. But there was a vague unease in the pit of my stomach, like the feeling you get when someone's staring at the back of your head. It followed me until my instincts got the better of me and I slipped into a side alley quick as a fish. As I stood pressed against a wall, waiting, the feeling faded. After a few minutes, I began to feel foolish. I trusted my instincts, but they gave false alarms every now and again. I waited a few more minutes just to be sure, then moved back into the street. The feeling of vague unease returned almost immediately. I ignored it while trying to find out where it was coming from, but after 5 minutes I lost my nerve and turned onto a side street, watching the crowd to see who was following me. No one. It took a nerve-wracking half hour and 2 more alleys before I finally figured out what it was. It felt strange to be walking with the crowd. Over the last couple of years, crowds had become a part of the scenery of the city to me. I might use a crowd to hide from a guard or a storekeeper. I might move through a crowd to get where I was going. I might even be going in the same direction as the crowd, but I was never part of it. I was so used to being ignored, I almost ran from the first merchant who tried to sell me something. Once I knew what was bothering me, the greater part of my uneasiness left. Fear tends to come from ignorance. Once I knew what the problem was, it was just a problem, nothing to fear. As I've mentioned, Tarbin has 2 main sections, hillside and waterside. Waterside was poor, hillside was rich. Waterside stank, hillside was clean. Waterside had thieves, hillside had burglars. I have already told the story of my 1 ill-auspiced venture hillside, so perhaps you will understand why, when the crowd in front of me happened to part for a moment, I saw what I was looking for. A member of the guard. I ducked through the nearest door, my heart pounding. I spent a moment reminding myself that I wasn't the same filthy little urchin who'd been beaten years ago. I was well-dressed and clean. I looked like I belonged here. But old habits die slow deaths.
I fought to control a deep red anger, but couldn't tell if I was angry at myself, the guard, or the world in general. Probably a little of each.
"Be right with you,"
came a cheerful voice from a curtained doorway. I looked around the shop. Light from the front window fell across a crowded workbench and dozens of shelved pairs of shoes. I decided I could have picked a worse store to wander into.
"Let me guess,"
came the voice again from the back. A grandfather grey man emerged from behind the curtain carrying a long piece of leather. He was short and stooped, but his face smiled at me through his wrinkles.
"You need shoes."
He smiled timidly as if the joke was a pair of old boots that had worn out long ago, but were too comfortable to give up. He looked down at my feet. I looked too, in spite of myself. I was barefoot, of course. I hadn't had shoes for so long that I never even thought about them anymore. At least not during the summer. In the winter, I dreamed of shoes. I looked up. The old man's eyes were dancing as if he couldn't decide whether laughing would cost him his customer or not.
"I guess I need shoes," I admitted.
He laughed and guided me into a seat, measuring my bare feet with his hands. Thankfully, the streets were dry, so my feet were merely dusty from the cobblestones. If there had been rain, they would have been embarrassingly filthy.
"Let's see what you like, and if I have anything of a size for you. If not, I can make or change a pair to fit you in an hour or two. So, what would you be wanting shoes for? Walking? Dancing? Riding?"
He leaned back on his stool and grabbed a pair off a shelf behind him.
"Walking?" "Thought so."
He deftly rolled a pair of stockings onto my feet, as if all his customers came in barefoot. He tucked my feet into a pair of something black with buckles.
"How's those feel? Put a little weight on to make sure." They're tight, I thought so. Nothing more annoying than a shoe that pinches."
He stripped me out of them and into another pair, quick as a whip.
"How about these?"
They were a deep purple and made of velvet or felt.
"They... not quite what you're looking for. Don't blame you, really. Wear out terribly fast. Nice colour, though. Good for chasing the ladies."
He patted a new pair onto my feet.
"How about these?"
They were a simple brown leather, and fit like he'd measured my feet before he'd made them. I pressed my foot to the ground, and it hugged me. I had forgotten how wonderful a good shoe can feel. "How much?" I asked apprehensively. Instead of answering, he stood and started searching the shelves with his eyes.
"You can tell a lot about a person by their feet,"
he mused.
"Some men come in here, smiling and laughing, shoes all clean and brushed, socks all powdered up, but when the shoes are off, their feet smell just fearsome. Those are the people that hide things. They've got bad-smelling secrets, and they try to hide them just like they try to hide their feet."
He turned to look at me.
"It never works, though. Only way to stop your feet from smelling is to let them air out a bit. Could be the same thing with secrets. I don't know about that, though. I just know about shoes."
He began to look through the clutter of his workbench.
"Some of these young men from the court come in, fanning their faces and moaning about the latest tragedy, but their feet are so pink and soft. You know, they've never walked anywhere on their own. You know, they've never really been hurt."
He finally found what he was looking for, holding up a pair of shoes similar to the pair I wore.
"Here we go. These were my Jacob's when he was your age."
He sat on his stool and unlaced the pair of shoes I was wearing.
"Now you,"
he continued,
"have old soles for a boy so young. Scars, calluses. Feet like these could run barefoot all day on stone and not need shoes. A boy your age only gets these feet one way."
He looked up at me, making it a question. I nodded. He smiled and laid a hand on my shoulder.
"How do they feel?"
I stood up to test them. If anything, they were more comfortable than the newer pair for being a little broken in.
"Now this pair,"
he waved the shoes he held,
"are new. They haven't been walked a mile, and for new shoes like these I charge a talent, maybe a talent and two."
He pointed at my feet.
"Those shoes, on the other hand, are used, and I don't sell used shoes."
He turned his back on me and started to tidy his workbench rather aimlessly, humming to himself. It took me a second to recognize the tune, "Leave the Town, Tinker." I knew that he was trying to do me a favor. and a week ago I would have jumped at the opportunity for free shoes. But for some reason I didn't feel right about it. I quietly gathered up my things and left a pair of copper jots on his stool before I left. Why? Because pride is a strange